Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, July 24th, 2022. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo. From the front page of today's Gazette, Boy survives park attack, Cedar Falls mayor says. Online fundraiser quickly reaches over $70,000 for the boy, from the Associated Press in Maquoketa. A 9-year-old Cedar Falls boy was spared in an attack that killed his parents and younger sister early Friday as they camped in the Maquoketa Caves State Park in eastern Iowa, according to the mayor of Cedar Falls. Mayor Rob Green issued a statement on Facebook saying that the family's son Arlo survived the attack and is safe. The Iowa Department of Public Safety identified the victims as Tyler Schmidt, 42, his 42-year-old wife Sarah Schmidt, and their 6-year-old daughter Lula Schmidt. Their bodies were found in their tent early Friday, and investigators said they had been shot. Authorities said the suspected gunman, 23-year-old Anthony Sherwin of Nebraska, was found dead in a wooded area of the park with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Mitch Mortvet, assistant director of the Department of Public Safety's Division of Criminal Investigation, told the Associated Press on Saturday that the motive for the attack was still unknown. "We don't know what led up to this, what precipitated it," he said, adding that so far, the investigation has not revealed any early interaction between the Schmidt family and him. Green said he is a neighbor of the Schmidts in Cedar Falls. His Facebook post did not say whether Arlo was in the tent when the shootings happened, and Green told the AP he did not have those details. Authorities would not immediately confirm the information in the mayor's post or make any comment about the boy. Sarah Schmidt worked at the Cedar Falls Public Library, which was closed Saturday after news of her death. "Like many of you just hearing the news, I'm devastated," Green wrote on Facebook. "I knew Sarah well, and she and her family were regular walkers here in the Sartori Park neighborhood. I was working with her this week on a public library tech presentation for 726. Their 9-year-old son Arlo survived the attack and is safe," Green wrote. "I've notified neighbors, and for those of you just learning about this through this post, I am so sorry." He said he would share upcoming details about services and memorials. By late Saturday, nearly $71,000 had flowed into a GoFundMe page created for Arlo. The page, which says it was organized by a cousin, Beth Shapiro, said Arlo is a strong boy surrounded by family and friends who are supporting him as best we can. The page says the fund will help Arlo now and help fund his future education. "We have no knowledge of the individual who conducted this act," Adam Morehouse, Sarah Schmidt's younger brother, told the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier on Saturday. "We don't know who it was, we've never met that person, and this was 100% random." The Schmidt family moved from Lawrence, Kansas to Cedar Falls around 2018 to be closer to Tyler's family. Morehouse said his sister and her family took to the community immediately. When storms hit, Sarah would call her brother for help with reading the radar so she could share the information with friends and neighbors. "Sarah and Tyler and Arlo and Lula were the Midwestern family that we would all want to be," Morehouse said. "They were extremely loving and compassionate to each other and everybody they met. They were always doing the right thing at the right time, and they were always that sound mind that you could have called when something like this would have happened." Tyler was a software engineer working remotely for a company based in the Kansas City area. Sarah started working at the library late in 2021 as an assistant in the circulation department. Library director Kelly Stern said she made the most of her short time there, and her impact will be felt for a long time. The killings prompted the evacuation of the park and campground, including a children's summer camp. After the evacuations, Sherwin was the only person unaccounted for, Mortvet said. He said that during the course of the investigation, authorities learned Sherwin was armed and that, of course, heightened our awareness. Iowa allows people with permits to carry firearms virtually anywhere in the state. Officials did not say if Sherwin had a permit and provided no information about the weapon that was used to kill the Schmidts. The Des Moines Register reported that Sherwin came from La Vista, Nebraska. La Vista Police Chief Bob Lawson told the newspaper that Sherwin had lived in an apartment complex with his parents and that he had no history of criminal conduct. Autopsies on Sherwin and the victims were scheduled to be performed over the weekend, Mortvet said, and more information would likely be released based on those findings. The state park and campground were closed until further notice. The Department of Natural Resources said in an email to the AP that campers with reservations through Thursday were given refunds. All of the campers who were at the park but not associated with the shooting have been able to retrieve their belongings, the Iowa DNR said. Also from the front page, jail deaths are unpreventable, Linn County Sheriff says. 7 people have died since 2020 while in the jail's custody, by Emily Anderson and Aaron Jordan of the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. Colleen Spencer and her family have been in mourning for over a year since her son, Travis Fulton, died by suicide July 10, 2021, in the Linn County Correctional Center. Fulton had just agreed to plead guilty to federal child pornography charges after repeatedly insisting to Spencer that he wouldn't. "I live it every day. I live through it every day and ask why," Spencer said of her son's death. "I thought he was stronger than that, but I think they broke him." Fulton is one of seven people to die in the jail since 2020. Going back to January 1, 2017, a period of over 5 years, the rate of deaths of inmates in the Linn County Jail has been more than twice as high as the rates for Polk, Scott, and Johnson counties in the same comparable period. Some died days or even hours after being locked up. Only one person was serving time on a prison sentence. Some, like Fulton, had pleaded guilty but hadn't been sentenced yet, and others still were awaiting trials to determine if they were guilty. When people are incarcerated, they no longer can see their own doctors or therapists and must turn their health and safety over to the agency in charge of the lockup. And when someone dies, it's not just an inmate to the family, it's someone's son, daughter, mom, dad, grandpa, or grandson. "You're correct in your assessment that seven seems like a high number," Linn County Sheriff Bryden Gardner, whose responsibilities include running the jail, told the Gazette in an interview. "We think the same thing, but when you look at the cause of death and the situation while they were in custody, I'm not sure that we could have changed any of these outcomes." A Gazette review of the seven Linn County deaths showed, "The Linn County Correctional Center is a 401-bed facility run by Gardner, who has worked for the sheriff's office since 1980 and was elected as sheriff in 2009, running as a Democrat. The jail houses people awaiting trial and serving time for state, county, and municipal offenses. The jail also houses overflow offenders from other counties and holds federal prisoners. At least 39 people died in Iowa's county jails from January 1, 2017 to May 31st, according to Iowa's Chief Jail Inspector Delbert Longley, who reviews investigation reports from each death. Longley initially told the Gazette there had been 33 jail deaths statewide since 2017, but his list left out jail deaths in Linn and Polk counties and did not include any deaths in Woodbury County, whose jail staff confirmed to the Gazette that one inmate has died in the jail since 2017. Longley, who works for the Iowa Department of Corrections, is charged by law with doing unannounced annual inspections at each of Iowa's 99 county jails and reporting to sheriffs and boards of supervisors about compliance with health and safety standards. He did not respond to requests for an interview about jail death investigations or to explain why his office had incomplete data on jail deaths across the state. "The information is acquired by the DOC from counties," Corrections Department spokesman Nick Crawford said in an email, adding that counties must alert Longley within 24 hours of any death in their jails. "The information we receive is only as good as what is provided from the county level. Mr. Longley works with counties to ensure they know and understand what information they require to provide him." Four of the Linn County jail deaths were ruled medical deaths. According to death certificates by the state medical examiner, Jacqueline Bridges, 59, and Marshall Mosby, 39, both died of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. Bridges on October 17, 2020, and Mosby on September 17, 2020. Mallory Holtz, 31, died on March 24th from complications of chronic substance use, and Charles Beasley, 34, died on May 14th from a bilateral pulmonary embolism. Staff screen new inmates about medical conditions, and each person gets a physical exam from the nursing staff after 72 hours, though Gardner said most people are released before then. Bridges, who was arrested for theft 5 hours before she died, had heart problems that she reported to jail staff. She asked a jail nurse to check her blood pressure an hour before she died, saying she had pain in her jaw. The test showed a blood pressure of 130 over 80, the investigative report said. According to the Mayo Clinic, a blood pressure of 130 over 80 means a person has stage 1 high blood pressure, but is not in crisis. Nurses trusted Bridges when she seemed satisfied with the reading, and she returned to her cell. An hour later, she was found unresponsive when a correctional officer went to get her because her bail had been paid. Beasley, who was transferred to the jail as a hold for the U.S. Marshal Service less than a month before he died, was suffering in the days before his death, fellow inmates said. He had been taken to Mercy twice, but was returned to jail both times, according to the investigation report. Other inmates who were in the same block as Beasley told investigators they had been getting him water because he had a hard time leaving his bed and that he hadn't been eating. One inmate said Beasley asked a deputy on the day he died if he could go to the hospital, but the deputy told him it wasn't his call. Mosby, who had been in the jail for more than a year on federal drug charges, also was showing signs of poor health the day he died. Mosby's sister, Yee Yee Oke Stokehouse, said he had recently had a procedure done on his heart. In her last conversation with him, he told her he was still having chest pains, but that a doctor had told him the pains would go away over time. According to the investigation report, jail surveillance footage from the day Mosby died showed him vomiting in the trash can multiple times. He didn't alert deputies that he was sick, and eventually other inmates called for help on his behalf. Medical staff attempted life-saving measures, but he was declared dead in jail. Okie Stokehouse said she believes Mosby's death was preventable, and she's considering taking legal action but hasn't talked with any lawyers. It has definitely traumatized us. We are still grieving tremendously because he died so suddenly, and we know, one, that if he wasn't in jail, he probably would still be alive, and two, that he was probably alone and they didn't really care about him passing. I'm sure they didn't do everything that they were supposed to do. Gary Dickey, a Des Moines lawyer who specializes in personal injury and civil rights cases, said he's been working with Holt's mother, Christy Caldwell, and stepfather, Chris Caldwell, to investigate Holt's death, but have not filed any court action. It would not be fair to say that we have committed to a lawsuit at this point, but I will tell you all signs point to the conclusion that this was a preventable death, Dickey said. Holtz was arrested March 23rd on an assault charge. She died from complications of chronic substance use the next morning after spending the night in a cell with one other person, according to the investigation report. Surveillance video showed she was restless throughout the night, hitting the call button in the cell several times, the report states. At about 12:45 a.m., she started moving suddenly while lying down as if she was having a seizure or trouble breathing. She then stopped moving and appeared to be asleep. Two more cell checks were logged before a corrections officer brought in another inmate around 2:15 a.m. and tried to wake up Holtz, not getting a response. The officer called for assistance and started giving CPR. Holtz was pronounced dead at the jail. There have been no changes at the Linn County Jail as a result of any of these deaths, but Gardner City is working towards a change that could help prevent overdose deaths, like that of Ryan Bailey on October 7, 2020. Bailey was booked into the jail 6 hours before his death as a hold for the Larry Nelson Center, a Cedar Rapids work-release center where he was serving time for a parole violation. Based on a review of video footage, it appears Bailey sneaked drugs into the jail by hiding them in his anus, according to the investigation report. The jail does not perform strip searches on incoming inmates unless the inmates clearly pose a risk to themselves or others or has a previous drug or weapons charge. When a strip search is performed, the jail staff doesn't touch the inmate but rather asks him or her to show different parts of their body. We could see if there's anything on their person. The problem with that is we can't see what is in a person, Gardner said. To address this, Gardner said he wants to purchase a body scanner similar to those used at airports. The jail, built in 1984, doesn't have space for a large machine, but Gardner said he's working on plans for a remodeling that could include more space. The State Corrections Department last year sought bids on a scanner for the Anamosa State Penitentiary to detect metal objects concealed in body orifices. The estimated cost was $11,000. Scanners that could detect non-metal items, such as concealed drugs, could cost more than $100,000. Turning to the Iowa Today and the Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state. New hospital costs skyrockets. University of Iowa Healthcare is requesting a 33% increase for construction of its new hospital in North Liberty, saying inflation and a workforce shortage are causing the cost to skyrocket. Hospital officials are asking the Iowa Board of Regents for approval on a revised budget for the 469,000-square-foot campus at Forever Green Road and Highway 965. The new price tag is $525.6 million. Candidate fundraising. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds raked in more than $633,000 between May 28th and July 14th, according to the latest campaign finance disclosure report. That total is more than double her Democratic challenger, Deidre DeGeer, who brought in close to $256,000 over the same period. In all, Reynolds has raised more than $5.8 million, while DeGeer, who formally entered the race last August, has raised $1.4 million. In the U.S. Senate race, Democrat Mike Franken, a former Navy admiral from Sioux City, outraised incumbent Republican Chuck Grassley over the last quarter, pulling in $1.8 million to Grassley's $800,000. Grassley holds a cash-on-hand advantage with more than $4 million in his campaign account, while Franken ended the period with $1.1 million cash on hand. Record casino income. Iowa's gamblers placed more than $4 billion in bets in both casino and sports games in the last fiscal year, a record for the state's gaming revenue. Iowa's 19 casinos brought in an adjusted gross revenue of nearly $1.78 billion from slot machines and table games, and another $2.4 billion in sports wagering. While casinos had high numbers in the first half of the fiscal year, betting slowed in the last 3 months as Iowans felt pressures from inflation putting a strain on household budgets. Marriage equality and contraception. Three of Iowa's U.S. House representatives, including two Republicans, voted in favor of a bill protecting the federal right to same-sex and interracial marriage. The bill passed the House with all Democrats and 47 Republicans in support. Iowa's U.S. senators didn't say last week how they'd vote on the bill as Democrats looked to get enough support to pass the bill in the Senate. Iowa's Republican U.S. House members voted against another House-passed bill seeking to establish a federal right to contraception. Representative Cindy Axne, a Democrat, voted in favor. Representatives Ashley Hinson and Marionette Miller-Meeks, both Republicans, introduced a competing bill last week that would make birth control pills available over-the-counter for women over 18. Auditor touts green buses. State Auditor Rob Sand encouraged school districts to seek federal funding for low- and zero-emission school buses. The Environmental Protection Agency is granting up to $500 million in grants this year to school districts who replace old diesel-powered buses with electric buses or buses that run on compressed natural gas or propane, which both emit less greenhouse gas than diesel. Sand said the buses can save costs for districts in the long term, as districts now struggle with historically high fuel prices. Electric buses also require less maintenance than traditional buses, he said. Under the heading, They Said, I have a good number of very close friends that are same-sex married, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican Iowa, on whether she supports same-sex marriage. And this should not be a partisan issue. This is a harm reduction issue. This is a public health issue. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller on proposed legislation to combat fentanyl overdoses. Under the heading Odds and Ends, Coralville Interchange. Big changes are expected when the long-awaited overhaul of the Interstate 80 and First Avenue interchange in Coralville begins. The $41 million project will impact traffic starting early next spring when First Avenue is reduced to one lane in each direction over the interstate, with work continuing into 2024. The current interchange, Exit 242, is a traditional diamond interchange that will be converted to a diverging diamond interchange, a design relatively new to Iowa but common in other states. Employment website restored. The Iowa Workforce Development website, which services unemployment claims and helps Iowans find jobs, is back up after nearly a month offline due to a cyber attack on Geographic Solutions, which maintains the website. New medical director. Dr. Robert Kruse, a director from the Mercy One system in Des Moines, is Iowa's new state medical director. Kruse succeeds Dr. Caitlin Pedati, who left her position last fall. Kruse will head the newly formed Department of Health and Human Services, which combines Iowa's Department of Public Health and Department of Human Services. Under the heading Water Cooler, Hawks Cyclones predict record year. The University of Iowa and Iowa State University Athletics Departments are expecting the 2023 budget year to be their most successful yet. UI Athletics expects to generate nearly $129 million in revenue, while ISU is predicting $106.2 million in the fiscal year that began July 1st, according to the Board of Regents documents. Both the UI's and ISU's athletic departments had a deficit in 2021 when ticket revenue to sporting events dropped off because of pandemic restrictions. UI expects more freshmen. The University of Iowa is scrambling to add more introductory classes for freshmen this fall, given that an incoming class of around 4,100 students is expected. Last year, 3,600 first-year students enrolled. And under the heading More in the News, COVID-19 cases up. New COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations in Iowa continue to rise in the past week following a significant spike the previous week. The state reported 5,301 new cases of the virus in the last week, up from 5,187 the week before. The number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 reached 256 statewide, up from 229 reported last week. Monkeypox. Johnson County Public Health has confirmed the first case of monkeypox within the county, making for the fifth confirmed case in the state. The telltale symptom of monkeypox is a rash that can look like pimples or blisters. These appear on the face, inside the mouth, and on other parts of the body, like the hand, feet, chest, or genitals. And outdoor grants. Linn and Blackhawk counties will receive $3.5 million of federal American Rescue Plan funds allocated by the state to finish paving the last 16 miles of the Cedar Valley Nature Trail that runs between Evansdale and Hiawatha. Governor Kim Reynolds' office announced the Destination Iowa grant funding Thursday. An outdoor recreation grant also went to Maquoketa and Jackson County Conservation. The city of Cedar Rapids is pairing its request for a share of $100 million in the federal funds from $27 million to $8.4 million. The money would be used to enhance the greenway along the Cedar River in Czech Village and New Bohemia. Turning to the Insight page, and first the column from editorial fellow Althea Cole, Two Things I Love, Trivia and Capitalism. Twice a week, I play trivia with some of my election office colleagues who are all pretty left-leaning politically. One of my teammates, an artsy-fartsy guy who started dabbling in socialism, offered me my turn at a book we're passing around to study for one of the more challenging categories. Unsure of when I'd have a moment to pick him up, I told him I'd hang on to it. "You don't have time because you're a capitalist," he said with a grin. Both of these things are true. I am a capitalist, and I don't always have a lot of free time, just money and satisfaction. Time was especially at a premium last week as I put in extra work before my week-long vacation to see family on the East Coast. In the interest of not overloading my brain, I decided to combine two things I love, capitalism and trivia, in today's column by posing a few trivia questions to readers on the innovative products produced under capitalism. The questions. 1. What ailment was John Smith Pemberton trying to cure when he invented the beverage that would eventually become Coca-Cola? 2. Who was the only American president to hold a patent? 3. What brand of vacuum cleaner was created using technology initially developed for the purpose of bomb detection? 4. What popular kitchen cupboard item was invented in 1946 by a failed landscaper-turned-amateur chemist who experimented with industrial waste? 5. What brand of blue cheese was invented by chemists at Iowa State University? The answers. 1. John Stith Pemberton was seeking a cure to his morphine addiction, stemming from a saber wound he sustained while fighting for the Confederacy when he created Pemberton's French Wine Coca, made from wine, the coca leaf, and the cola nut. It was advertised in 1885 as a nerve tonic. Pemberton had to revise his formula to remove the wine when Atlanta introduced prohibition in 1886. Renamed Coca-Cola by Pemberton's business partner, the new syrup was combined with carbonated water and sold at a pharmacy for 5 cents a glass. Pemberton was a well-respected pharmacist, but not much of a businessman. That's my dog and her toes. Coca-Cola exploded in popularity only after Pemberton sold the recipe shortly before his death to Asa Griggs Candler, a local business tycoon. 2. Years before his presidency, Abraham Lincoln invented a device for buoying vessels over shoals and was granted a patent in 1849. Lincoln had worked as a ferryman in his youth, carrying passengers and other cargo on his small boat. On more than one occasion, his boat had gotten stuck on a shoal or a submerged sandbank, frequently hidden from plain sight. Getting unstuck usually meant unloading cargo, so Lincoln's device was designed to carry inflatable bellows on the side to lift the vessel high enough to be freed from the bank. While Lincoln was enthusiastic about the innovation spurred by capitalism, we'll never know if his invention would have worked. It was never actually produced. 3. The company iRobot was founded in 1990 by three researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. By 1996, they had developed software for an autonomous robot that featured object recognition technology intended to detect and dispose of explosives. After receiving a contract from the Department of Defense to build a robot that was later used to search for survivors in the rubble of the World Trade Center after the September 11th attacks, the company expanded into the consumer market, creating a robotic vacuum cleaner, which you might know as the Roomba. 4. Earl Silas Tupper was a tree surgeon whose landscaping business went bankrupt during the Great Depression. He worked for 1 year at a plastics manufacturer called the DuPont Viscoloid Company, which is often mistaken for the larger, well-known chemical company DuPont. After leaving DuPont Viscoloid to form his own company, Tupper started experimenting with polyethylene slag, an industrial waste product which he obtained from his former employer. After trial and error, he was able to refine the black, smelly, inflexible material to a translucent, odorless plastic that could be molded and remain durable, and in 1946, Tupperware was created. After initially low retail sales, Tupperware began selling exclusively through home parties in 1951. 5. Before the creation of Maytag blue cheese was made using milk from a sheep or a goat. In the 1930s, Fred Maytag of Maytag Dairy Farms in Newton, Iowa, approached food scientists at Iowa State College, now Iowa State University, looking for ways to diversify the use of milk from his and his brother's Holstein cows. Maytag offered to pay royalties and furnish a factory in exchange for Iowa State developing the process. The collaboration was successful and the technology remains in use today. I'll admit it, I didn't want to work too hard before my vacation. Perhaps it's a bit ironic then that I wrote about some of America's hardest workers. Their contributions were made possible thanks to a system that has made America what it is today. Capitalism, the voluntary exchange of goods and services for mutual benefit in a free market, where anyone can become an entrepreneur and market the next life-changing product. Entrepreneurship breeds innovation in the neatest ways sometimes. Sometimes it's by accident. The inventor of Silly Putty was looking to create a rubber substitute during World War II and instead invented a bouncy novelty sold in toy stores. Sometimes it's on a whim. A track coach at the University of Oregon had been looking to develop a better running shoe when he experienced an aha-type moment while looking at his waffle iron. He used it to create the prototype for the Waffle Trainer, Nike's flagship shoe product. However it happens, the standard of living we enjoy today is in part because we had an idea and decided to capitalize on it. And Todd Dorman's column, 24-Hour Dorman, danger ahead for Iowa Democrats. It's time for a loud wake-up call, Iowa Democrats. You're sleepwalking through a race for governor with stakes that couldn't be much higher. Rise and shine, your state's future is on the line. We know you don't think Republican Governor Kim Reynolds is doing a bang-up job. Last weekend's Des Moines Register Iowa poll showed that just 10% of Democrats approve of Reynolds' job performance. She's assailing public schools so she can give private schools public money. She's likely to lead the charge for tight restrictions on abortion. She's targeting struggling Iowans, claiming they're lounging in hammocks. Reynolds is a divisive figure who has drawn intense criticism from Democrats. For good reason. These are issues Democrats are supposed to care about deeply. Sure, Reynolds has opened up a 17-point lead over Democratic nominee Deidre DeGeer, but there are vulnerabilities in the numbers. Reynolds' approval rating among independents is 46%, with 47% disapproving, according to the Iowa poll. Just 42% of Iowans surveyed think the state is on the right track, including just 33% of independents. And yet, DeGeer has the backing of just 78% of Democrats. That may sound okay, but it's 10 points less than Democratic U.S. Senate nominee Mike Franken, a white guy. Reynolds' support among Republicans is 91%. 5% of Democrats say they support Libertarian candidate Rick Stewart. Then came the campaign finance disclosures filed this past week. Between May and July, Reynolds tossed $633,000 onto her money pile, which has reached a height of $5.2 million. The governor spent $235,000 during the period. Meanwhile, DeGeer raised $256,000 and has $503,000 in her campaign account. She spent $170,000. Although campaigns like to talk about all the small donations they get from average voters, we know it's the more generous contributors who truly fuel campaign fundraising. Reynolds has them. DeGeer does not. Between May and July, Reynolds received 23 $5,000 donations, two $7,500 donations, 10 $10,000 donation, one $15,000 donation, and four $25,000 donations. That's $325,000 in contributions, more than half of her total, from just 41 donors. The $25,000 donations came from the Bob Van Deest Trust in Webster City, Duck McCannich of Johnston, Mike Bennett of Sioux City, and Jim Balloon of Atlanta. Van Deest is the founder of a farm chemical manufacturing company. McCannich is CEO of a grading and underground utilities firm. Bennett is the former CEO of Terra Industries, a nitrogen fertilizer company. Balloon is an Iowa State University alum who is the former CEO of Acuity Brands, a lighting and building management company. DeGeer received just three $5,000 donations and nothing larger. One $5,000 donation was from former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. Another was from Jennifer DeBrenzia, a school board member in Palo Alto, California. The other was from Tanner Krause of Des Moines, CEO of Come & Go. DeGeer is in a better position than Democratic gubernatorial nominee Jack Hatch was in July 2014. Hatch raised $270,000 between May and July, but had just $183,000 in the bank. He went on to lose 98 counties. DeGeer is a much stronger candidate than Hatch, no offense to the former state senator. But during the same period in 2018, Democrat Fred Hubble raised $2.6 million, and no, that did not include self-financing, and had $1.9 million in the bank. Included among his contributions was a $250,000 check from the Democratic Governors Association PAC and $100,000 from the ISEA. The ISEA has yet to donate to DeGeer, even as she challenges the most anti-public education governor in the state's recent history. So what gives, big Democratic givers? Maybe you think she's not competitive, which is a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is no time to hedge bets. Do you not want to invest in making history by helping make DeGeer Iowa's first black governor? Or does that prospect make you uncomfortable enough to sit on your wallets? We'd all like to know. We already know former Democratic candidate for governor Representative Ross Smith struggled to get traditional donors to meet with him or even return his calls. I wonder along the way, what misstep did I make? Did I not shake a hand at the right event? Did I not pass the right policy to not show up? I've got a case full of plaques that they said I was doing a dang good job, but when it comes to the fact that I call to have a conversation, I don't even get a return phone call back. No answer back, Smith told me back in December. It's no stretch to believe the same shameful obstacles are being faced by DeGeer. The Democratic Party, the progress that we made, has been built on the backs of black bodies for a long time. Black people are the base of the Democratic Party, Smith said. Does anything more need to be said? I'm not going to pretend that DeGeer's campaign is lighting the state on fire. It needs to be far more aggressive and visible, but that's tough when you lack resources. Anyone who's seen Degere speak or has spent time talking with her understands she's a high-quality candidate. Her message supporting public schools, reproductive rights, and working people is strong. She's offering a clear alternative to Reynolds' brand of Trump-endorsed, spiteful Fox News governance. She needs to get better known and more widely heard, and that takes money. Yes, the polls look bad, but no election is over in July. At this point in 1998, Tom Vilsack trailed Jim Ross Lightfoot by 21 points, and yes, I clearly understand Iowa politics has changed dramatically and we've taken a sharp right turn, but there's still plenty of time to make it a race. The fight isn't over. Or, Iowa Democrats, you can just give up and curl up into a demoralized slumber. Reynolds can start sending her $5.2 million to the Iowa GOP for legislative and down-ballot races. Without a strong effort at the top of the state ticket, Democrats holding the offices of Attorney General, Auditor, and Treasurer will be in real jeopardy. As Reynolds has demanded, they'll be replaced by her Attorney General and her Auditor. The transformation of the State House into a bastion of red state trailblazers will be complete. Checks and balances will leave the building. Just think what they'll do with all that power and no brakes. The Democratic Party will be on life support, and you think losing the caucuses is bad. That's not just a wake-up call you're hearing, Democrats. It's a warning siren. Alarm bells, flashing red lights, and flares launching upward. Peril is dead ahead unless you get to work. And in turning today's editorial cartoon and community letter, the editorial cartoon from Clay Bennett, a syndicated cartoonist distributed by Counterpoint Media, shows an outdoor thermometer, which is pegged 20 degrees higher than 80 at the temperature reading OMG. The first letter is from Steve Patton of Cedar Rapids. A day in the life of the tolerant left. Woke up, got out of bed. What to do today? First, I will hate Trump. Second, I will hate the Supreme Court. Third, I will hate Ron DeSantis. Then I will show the world how tolerant I am. Repeat. That was Steve Patton of Cedar Rapids. Next, Peter Hansen of Iowa City writes, are mass shootings just about evil? Regarding red flag laws, the Gazette last Sunday quoted Governor Kim Reynolds as saying, no matter how many laws or rules you have on the books, if somebody has evil in their heart, you can't handle that. Assuming she is correct, this implies that a far greater percentage of Americans must have evil in their heart because other countries experiencing only a small fraction of the number of mass shootings that occur in the United States. Peter Hansen of Iowa City. Next, Judy Fole of Iowa City writes, why the changes to Coralville Interchange? Is it too late to stop the big change to the Coralville Interstate intersection? Why is the state spending millions of road tax dollars to upgrade a usable intersection when the money could be used to fix the dangerous bridges in Iowa? Why a separate expensive tunnel for a few pedestrians? Why block delivery access for gas trucks for the years it will take to finish construction? Judy Fole of Iowa City. Next, Shirley Burnett of Cedar Rapids writes, respect for Liz Cheney. I am a longtime Democrat, but I have to admit I have profound respect for Republican Representative Liz Cheney in her role as Vice Chairman of the January 6th Committee. Her presentation of the facts is made clear and concise, making it easy to understand the importance of those facts in proving former President Donald Trump's guilt in the attempted coup by his minions on January 6th. Republicans need to pay attention to the January 6th committee hearings and turn their backs on Trump and his cohorts and their unending lies. It is so very important that the rule of law continue to properly function in our beloved United States of America and not become a fascist banana republic. Shirley Burnett of Cedar Rapids. Next, Dave Bradley of West Liberty. Remember Grassley's role in overturning Roe. Iowa U.S. Senate candidate Mike Franken supports constitutionally protected abortion. Therefore, let's consider Senator Chuck Grassley's insidious role in the Supreme Court decision to end Roe v. Wade. As Senate Judiciary Chairman in 2016, Grassley held open a Supreme Court seat, refusing to consider President Barack Obama's nominee, asserting it was the last year of Obama's presidency. But in President Donald Trump's last weeks in office, Grassley advanced Amy Coney Barrett, who voted to end Roe. Grassley said, together, President Trump and I cemented a conservative 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court. Grassley cares little that the court is wreaking havoc on our lives. Grassley is a leader of the radical right. 63% of Americans support abortion rights. Six unelected justices subverted the will of nearly 2/3 of Americans while making women second-class citizens, thanks to Grassley. While moving abortion issues to the states, the court just made gun issues national, counter to its ruling on abortion. The court reduced the ability of the Environmental Protection Agency to curb carbon emissions as the world faces catastrophic climate change. Thanks, Grassley. The three new Supreme Court justices appointed by the previous president, along with Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and John Roberts, will likely serve for another 20 years, thus blocking progress in all areas. We're losing precious freedoms. Grassley's cruel intentions were planned. Grassley answers to the radical right, not Iowans. Ending Grassley's grip on power is imperative. Electing Mike Franken in November will help restore liberty. Dave Bradley of West Liberty. And George Koonsman of Cedar Rapids writes, Roe v. Wade was established law. In CNN's e-newsletter, Meanwhile in America, on July 20th, it states Roe v. Wade was established law. According to Congress and the Supreme Court, slavery was established law in the United States until it was declared to be unconstitutional. Is there anyone out there who agrees that the Supreme Court should not have found slavery to be unconstitutional? Sometimes it is right for the Supreme Court to change its mind. George Koonsman of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, July 24th, 2022, on the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service. I am your reader, Sharon Falduto, and we turn to today's obituaries. Connie J. Henderson, age 88, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Wednesday, July 20th, at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Family will greet friends and family from 4 to 7 p.m. with a rosary beginning at 3:30 p.m. Friday, July 29th, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A funeral mass will be at 9 a.m. Saturday, July 30th, at St. Matthew Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. The Reverend Douglas Loke will officiate. Burial will follow at Greenwood Cemetery in Cedar Falls. Connie lived in Cedar Falls for over 40 years and partnered with her husband running Henderson Traffic Bureau until her retirement in 2004. Connie was a member of St. Matthew Catholic Church. She enjoyed quilting, making a quilt for every grandchild. Connie was an excellent cook. Mary Catherine Nerad, 81, of Solon, passed away on Thursday, July 21st, in her home. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, July 27th, at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Solon, located at 100 South Cedar Street, lower level. Celebration of Life services will be 11 a.m. Thursday, July 28th, at Brosh Chapel. Private family interment will be at a later date in Oakland Cemetery. Mary worked at Victor Metal and at Thomas & Betts until her retirement. Later, she worked part-time at the Solon Care Center. She enjoyed shopping, gardening, tending to her flowers, going dancing with Wilbur, and most of all, spending time with her family. Glenna J. Wilt, born Glenna J. Neve, age 85, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, July 6th, at her home in Windsor Manor in Vinton. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, July 29th, at the Vinton Presbyterian Church with Dr. Dennis Morey officiating. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the Phillips Funeral Home Chapel, 212 East 6th Street in Vinton. Interment will be held at Maplewood Cemetery in Vinton. David William Altdorfer Jr., 68, of Marion, unexpectedly went to be with the Lord Jesus on Sunday, July 10th. David served his country honorably for 22 years, U.S. Navy, retiring as Chief Petty Officer, was actively working as a metrologist for Collins Aerospace, teaching Sunday school, Big Brother volunteer, power weightlifter, former basketball coach, and referee umpire. He often said he was sure of only two things, that he was a sinner and was saved by grace through faith in Christ alone. He wore out his Bibles with deep study over the last decade and a heart for sharing the gospel. A public memorial service and reception will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, July 29th, at Calvary Community Church, 327 35th Street Northeast, Cedar Rapids. Joanne Marie Moses, 84, of Ely, passed away on Wednesday, July 20th, at West Ridge Care Center. Private graveside services will be held at Rogers Grove Cemetery near Ely. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids are in charge of arrangements. Joanne worked at People's Bank and at Square D until staying home to raise her children and farm with Hank. She enjoyed gardening, tending to her chickens, reading, word finds, and most of all, spending time with her family. Ellen Marie Todd, 90, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully on Friday, July 8th. Visitation will be held on Friday, July 29th at 10 a.m. and funeral service at 11 a.m. in the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Interment will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery Chapel Garden. Ellen retired from Rockwell Collins and member of Fourscore. Her life revolved around family. She was a creative person, seamstress, fantastic cook, and loved to entertain. She loved gardening and maintained a greenhouse full of hundreds of orchid plants as a hobby. Ronald Emery Eichen, 78, of Solon, died Wednesday, January 1, 2020, at the Solon Nursing Care Center. Celebration of life will be held from 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, July 30th at Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Solon, located at 100 South Cedar Street, lower level. The time of sharing Ron stories will begin at 3 p.m. Robert I. Crane, known as Bob, age 91, of Springville, passed away on Thursday, July 21st at his home. A graveside service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, July 30th at Springville Cemetery in Springville, Murdoch. Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion, Iowa is assisting the family. Bob worked for Borden Ice Cream and later Link Belt Inc. in Cedar Rapids for 33 and a half years. He went on to work for the Springville School District until his retirement. Bob was a collector of cigarette lighters. He enjoyed fishing, hunting, going to the casino, and playing scratch-off lotto tickets. Bob loved to visit with anyone and always had a story to tell. Marlon Edward Frankson Sr., 82, of Cape Fear, Missouri, formerly of Center Point, Iowa, passed away Tuesday, July 19th. A visitation will be held from 10 a.m. to noon Saturday, July 30th, at Sellergren Lindell DeMars in Red Oak, Iowa. A funeral service will take place at noon immediately following the visitation. A celebration of life will take place from noon to 4 p.m. Saturday, August 20th, at Hiawatha American Legion, 735-207 Robbins Road. Marlon was employed at Hamilton Standard, a subsidiary of United Aircraft. In 1964, he worked for the NASA Space Program in the Special Test Equipment Division. In 1967, he went to work for the Department of Defense, working for the Navy as a quality assurance representative located in the General Electric plant in Pittsfield, Mass. He fought a brave battle with stage 4 cancer since 2010. Marlon enjoyed spending time with his family, being outdoors, traveling, fishing in Canada, and old cars. He was employed by the U.S. Department of Defense as an administrative contracting officer for the states of Iowa and Nebraska. Marcella A. Stolba of Cedar Rapids. On March 30th, 2022, our mother's body finally caught up with her mind, and she passed away peacefully after suffering for several years with dementia. Nearly 3 years from the passing of our dad, Robert, who suffered from the same disease. Interestingly, she died at the age of 91. Our dad died at 91, and our Bobby, Mom's mother, also died at the age of 91. Marcella cleaned houses for the neighbors and sold Avon and Tupperware, and she had the Tupperware to show for it. She started working for Iowa Illinois Gas and Electric as a clerk in the service department in 1961 and retired from there in 1991. In retirement, she worked part-time in a school cafeteria and volunteered at Mercy Medical Center. There will be a celebration of life at 1 p.m. Saturday, July 30th at Papich Cuba Funeral Home East, 1228 2nd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. There will be a brief gravesite service at Campbell Cemetery following the celebration. Blue was Marcella's favorite color, and we would like to invite all who attend to wear something blue. Michael Maurice Black, known as Mike, age 69, of Cedar Rapids, died on Friday, July 22nd, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy following a battle with cancer. A celebration of life will be held on Monday, July 25th, in the Monarch Room at TN Funeral Home from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Mike was a steel polisher and machinist through the years, working for Cherry, Burrell, Evergreen, Midland Forge, and Midwest Metals, retiring in 2018. Mike enjoyed riding Harleys and bought his first one in 1972. He was a member of Abate, a brotherhood of motorcycle enthusiasts that works towards education and safety for riders. He loved to participate in poker runs and charity rides, including for the Divas Motorcycle Club. Merle James Jennings, 86, of Moline, Illinois, entered eternity on July 20th while under the care of Unity Point Trinity Hospital in Bettendorf. Funeral Mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, August 1st, St. Mary's Catholic Church in Tipton, Monsignor Francis Henriksen officiating. Burial and final rites will conclude at St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 3 to 6 p.m. Sunday, July 31st at Fry Funeral Home in Tipton. Bonita Grace Connolly, née Burroughs, who was born on October 11, 1933, passed away peacefully after a short illness on July 13, 2022, in Salem, Oregon. Making music came easily to Bonita, and in great variety. As a four-year-old, she sat and played the VFW piano by ears. Bonita deeply touched the lives of myriad students at Mountain View Elementary and ultimately across the Anchorage School District. A few of Bonita's most stellar students remained in touch across her lifetime, and their unfolding lives gave her the greatest of joy. Her career trajectory led through becoming an ASD reading specialist, then a Slingerland teacher focused on instruction for students with dyslexia, and then into a master's degree from the University of Alaska, Anchorage. Friends and family will gather on Friday, August 5th at 1:30 for a memorial service at Relevant Life Church, South Campus, 1090 Fairview Avenue Southeast in Salem, Oregon. In the summer of 2023, family and friends will gather again for celebration. Kenneth S. Bryant, age 85, of Camdenton, Missouri, formerly of Vinton, Iowa, died Saturday, June 11th, at home. There will be a family graveside service at Garrison Cemetery in Iowa. Ken was an Iowa farm boy and played fullback on the high school football team. He worked many years for Penn-Dixie as a cement salesman and later served the same customers as a cement chemical sales manager. He looked forward to big game hunting every fall out west. He was known for his homemade ice cream and his Chevy trucks. Marcy Jo Myex, age 63, of Marion, passed away unexpectedly on June 9th. Marcy had an incredible voice and a love of music. She was the lead in the first opera performed at Iowa State University, where she attended in over a century. She managed the soundstage at Paisley Park and was the last employee at Prince's studio when it finally ceased operations. She went on to work for other recording studios in Minneapolis as well before she moved to Marion. A memorial will be held at a future date. Interment will be at Kissling Cemetery in Urbana, Iowa. And turning to the sports page, under the heading Iowa Athletics Name, Image, and Likeness, it's all about the money. Coaches see collective as absolutely essential for survival, by John Stepp of the Gazette and University Heights. Ohio State's number is $13 million. That's how much football coach Ryan Day thinks Buckeye boosters need to raise annually for name, image, and likeness to keep his roster intact, according to a JuneCleveland.com report. I don't have that big of a number in mind, said Brad Hendricks, the CEO of Iowa's Swarm Collective, at a Tuesday news conference. But still, the number at Iowa will probably have plenty of zeros at the end of it. We're going to need several million dollars to help us go where we want to go, Hendricks said. Whether that's 5, 10, I'm not sure, but we've got a ways to go. At the same time, Hendricks said he'll likely have a better idea of what's possible in 30 days. The Swarm Collective, where any interested athletes in football, men's basketball, and women's basketball can profit from fans while supporting nonprofits, is in its infancy after officially launching on Tuesday. The several million dollars number for NIL revenue may have some sticker shock, but it'd be a fraction of what Iowa Athletics receives annually in donations. In the 2018-19 fiscal year, the most recent year with data available that was not affected by COVID-19, Iowa brought in about $35.4 million in contributions, according to the Iowa's NCAA financial report. If donors either increased their giving to Hawkeye causes from 2018-19 by 14% or diverted 14% of their contributions from UI Athletics to the collective, that would be enough for the collective to have $5 million. Hendricks refuted the idea that his collective will compete with the athletics department for donors. Do I view it as a competition? No, Hendricks said. We're all Hawks. We're all trying to further the brand. As Hendricks unveiled the collective publicly Tuesday, Iowa coaches did not understate its importance. It's absolutely essential for survival, Iowa men's basketball coach Fran McCaffrey said after Hendricks' news conference. The hope is it will keep us on a level playing field. Iowa football coach Kirk Ferentz similarly described the collective as critical for the Hawkeyes to keep up with their peers. NIL is not going away, Ferentz said. You can put your head in the sand, or you try to address it. Ferentz at first really didn't spend much time worrying about NIL, but that changed in February. Since February, I've really tried to immerse myself a little bit and get knowledgeable, Ferentz said. Many other schools already have collectives in place. Other Big Ten schools, where boosters have already established NIL collectives, include Wisconsin, Nebraska, Illinois, Ohio State, Penn State, and Indiana. Some are further along in operations than others, though. After its June 4th unveiling, the varsity collective at Wisconsin has essentially been silent, per a Wisconsin State Journal report. As the differences in NIL goals between Iowa and Ohio State showed, survival in the NIL era will likely look different for the Hawkeyes than for some of the top-tier football programs. We've never been in that ballpark, Ferentz said. It's just like we don't have 110,000 seats in our stadium, and we shouldn't. That's not us. Ferentz compared it to the existing differences in recruiting between Iowa and a school like Ohio State or Alabama. The Hawkeyes' 2022 class is 30th in rivals rankings, while Ohio State's class is 4th and Alabama's class is 2nd. We're not going to beat Alabama or Ohio State on a recruit, unless their dad played here or they had a brother here, Ferentz said. There's exceptions to that rule, but we haven't built our program that way. A top-dollar prospect might not be a good fit in Iowa City anyway, regardless of the sport. Iowa Women's Basketball Associate Head Coach Jan Jansen said the players recruited in football and men's and women's basketball usually aren't chasing the glitz and glamour of a Hollywood market. You're going to lose some that want a Lamborghini, but they're never going to be who we are here, Jansen said. And in girls' basketball, Freeze elevated to head coach at West, by Jeff Linder of the Gazette in Iowa City. Nate Freeze's first comment as head girls basketball coach at Iowa City West was the following. I bet you want to hear about all the things I'm going to overhaul, don't you? He was kidding. Freeze, 48, was named Friday morning, pending board approval. He spent the last three seasons as B.J. Mayer's assistant, the 20 years before that on Steve Bergman's staff on the boys' side. "I want to maintain what B.J. has done," Freeze said. "I have big shoes to fill. I don't envision changing a lot. Our styles are pretty similar." Mayer resigned in June when he was named West's athletic director. "I'm excited to have Nate take over the girls' program after serving as an assistant in many capacities," Mayer said in a news release. "He is very knowledgeable about the game of basketball, knows the kids in the program, and is familiar with West High School and the basketball program." Nate has been an integral part of the success the past 3 years and will now have the opportunity to share more of his leadership skills as the head coach. West returned 73% of its scoring from a team that finished 19-4 last year, led by seniors Mina Tate, a recent Dartmouth College commit, and Anna Prouty. "Our last four postseason losses have come against CIML teams, and I want us to be able to challenge those teams," Freeze said. "I want the girls to have valuable experiences in wins and losses and in building character." An English teacher at West, Nate and his wife Nikki have a daughter, Ava, who will be a freshman. The Iowa Profile, "Farmer Seeks New Markets for African Vegetables," by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette in Iowa City. "Most Iowans don't know how to cook with pumpkin leaves, hibiscus leaves, and amaranth, but Alfred Matiapo grew up with these African crops and believes he can find new markets in the United States. Matiapo, 43, grows greens, eggplant, and several varieties of hot peppers on 2.5 acres he rents at the Johnson County Historic Poor Farm. I didn't want to face the competition, so I chose specialty crops that you can't typically find near local farmers markets," he said. Matiapo's company, Africando Foods, sells produce online and at local African and international grocery stores. But there are a limited number of these stores in eastern Iowa, which has caused Matiapo to drive his produce to stores in Des Moines, southern Illinois, and as far as Ohio. Shipping fresh produce also is expensive. Now he's thinking of new ways to get his produce to African immigrants and to Iowans interested in trying new foods. Matiapo grew up in the Congo, where farmers grow food crops including cassava, plantains, maize, groundnuts, yams, beans, peas, and rice. Nearly one-third of Congolese people are involved in agriculture, as was Matiapo's family. He went to college at the University of Maine, graduating with an engineering degree in 2004. "That's when a lot of jobs were outsourcing," he said. "I really didn't want to work in the field." Matiapo tried farming in Maine and learned about value-added agriculture, which involves turning a raw product into something new, such as the Alfredo hot sauce that Matiapo makes from the peppers he grows. The hot sauce is available for sale by the bottle at Wawa Caribbean Restaurant, African Family Market and Sisters African Food Market in Cedar Rapids, and World Food Market, Modena African Market, and Iowa City Halal Food and Grocery in Iowa City. Matiapo moved to Iowa with his family in 2017. He and his wife, Grace Muzemba, have 7 kids, 16 months to 17. He has been farming at the Poor Farm since 2017, first working with the Global Food Project. He started renting 2 acres in 2018, and with the purchase of a tractor this year, hopes to expand to 4 acres this summer. In larger metro areas, such as Washington, D.C., there is demand for greens traditionally grown in Africa, but those urban markets aren't always accessible to rural farmers. Matiapo is hoping to expand his freezing capacity so he can sell frozen produce to outlets nationwide. He also would like to get a better delivery truck to transport fresh produce to Midwest stores without fear of it spoiling or being damaged in transit. "There's enough markets, it's just logistics," he said. Producers of African greens should post nutritional information and recipes on their retail sites, according to Michael Carter Jr., a Small Farm Resource Center coordinator within the Virginia State University Extension. The Africando Foods website includes this sort of information, such as how to substitute many of the leaves for spinach. And finally today, The Time Machine, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. "Were Iowa Brothers Not Guilty in 1884 Murder?" by Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. Iowa Governor George W. Clark, who took office in 1913, was asked in 1915 to pardon brothers Frank and Nate Rainsbarger. The brothers had been convicted of murdering Frank's father-in-law, Enoch Johnson, on November 18, 1884, in Hardin County, about 45 miles west of Waterloo. They'd been in prison almost 30 years for a murder many thought they did not commit. Clark at first was inclined to deny the brothers clemency, but curiosity led him to investigate the notorious case. The governor became so interested in the particulars that he rode the 20-mile route in a horse and buggy that the Rainsbergers supposedly took to kill Johnson, from Cleves to Gifford and back. He found it couldn't be done in the time prosecutors had claimed at the brothers' trial. He was convinced the Rainsbergers were innocent. With an abundance of caution, though, he decided they would be on probation for 3 years. If they passed those years without incident, they would be pardoned. In central Iowa, the Rainsbergers were compared to the Jesse James gang. At least news stories claim that, most of them originating in the local paper, the Eldora Herald. But time would reveal the paper's editor, James S. Ross, was on the payroll of a counterfeit ring and was being fed information by William Hierstadt, the ring's apparent leader, according to a 1992 article in the Palimpsest, the history journal published by the State Historical Society of Iowa. Then, in 1884, Enoch Johnson, Frank Rainsberger's father-in-law, was arrested for counterfeiting. Johnson's daughter, Nettie, insisted that her husband bail out her father. After Johnson was released, his body was found on the road from Gifford to Abbott. At first, it was believed his death was an accident, but the evidence, including a cracked skull, pointed to murder. Nettie was furious about her father's death and persuaded authorities to arrest Frank, her husband, and his brother Nate for murder. It was the state's theory the brothers had planned to take out life insurance policies on Johnson, dress a cadaver in his clothes, and stage a runaway horse and buggy accident during which the cadaver would be thrown into the river. When the decomposed body was recovered, it would be unrecognizable, and they would collect $16,500 in insurance. Frank and Nate Rainsberger were convicted in separate trials in 1887 of murdering Frank's father-in-law and were sentenced to life in prison. The brothers became model prisoners and trustees at the prison. Frank was in charge of the prison carpenter shop and the only inmate allowed to keep a dog. Nate was a pattern maker in the machine shop. In 1906, they petitioned Iowa Governor Albert Cummins for a pardon. It was denied. In 1908, Iowa Supreme Court Justice Silas Weaver investigated the case for 2 years and took the unusual step of petitioning the state parole board, asking that the brothers be released because he believed they were innocent. In anticipation of their release, the brothers had made wooden souvenirs in the carpenter shop to help pay their legal costs. The parole board denied their release. In 1911, Iowa Governor B.F. Carroll denied clemency to the Rainsbergers, declaring a life sentence should be commuted only in the most extraordinary circumstances and that the brothers didn't qualify. On August 25, 1915, 28 years after their imprisonment, Governor Clark pardoned the brothers. The Rainsbergers, deprived of their liberty nearly 30 years ago for a crime which probably a majority of the people of Iowa never believed they committed, today for the first time in a generation breathed the air of freedom, the Gazette reported. By then, Nathan was 64 and Frank was 58. By December 1916, Nathan was living in Marshalltown and working for the Western Grocer Company Mills. Frank did contract work near Ackley. Frank died in Abbott on November 15, 1926. Nathan was 88 when he died at the home of his niece in Marshalltown in 1940. Both are buried in the Steamboat Rock Cemetery. That brings us to the end of Reading the Gazette for Sunday, July 24th, 2022. I've been your reader, Sharon Faldudo. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other IRIS recordings at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.com. We welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.